Thank you so much for joining us today. You're listening to Corrieton Cast, the official podcast of Corrieton Church. Today we'll hear more from Rocky and Betsy's friend, author Jan Silvius. In today's episode, Dr. Rocky Ramsey is interviewing one of his favorite authors and speakers, Jan Silvius, on real Christian grieving, responding to and making changes, and much more wisdom from Jan Silvius.
Many of you know that I was raised heathen, and I really was I don't know if I was a bigger moral mess or emotional mess, but I was definitely both. And six people, God has used six people in my life, one I've never met actually is his book, that have taken me from where I was to where I am. I was, if you'd asked anybody in high school, I was the least liked person to ever be a pastor. If you ask anybody probably in college, they would have said I was the least likely person to last more than 3 years at a church. And here I am 40 years deep. And so God has radically changed me. He's used six people, and one of those people is Jan Silvius. Intelligence is one thing. It's genetic. This may shock you, but Elon Musk is smarter than I am. Okay? It's genetic. You can't change that. Knowledge is academic. You can study and learn stuff. You can learn facts. But wisdom is more than both of those. Wisdom is knowing how to take knowledge and apply it to life. And so Jan's one of the wisest people I know, and she just excels at that. And so she brings to us a lot of wisdom. She's 80 years old. She doesn't look it. I was just thinking, if I make it to 50 years, I will be 79. But I probably won't be looking as good as you do at your age anyway. So I'm going to ask her a series of questions, and we'll just kind of see where this thing goes. So let's see where we want to begin here. How about this one? Have you always been interested in writing about relationships, about things that work and don't work? Has that been something?
It's been a lot of interest because I've worked as a counselor, and that was sort of through the back door. I was thrown into a counseling office. I learned at the feet of Kay Arthur, and some of you know who she is, but in her early days, she was a Bible teacher, and after our Bible study, she set up 15-minute counseling appointments, which is bizarre, but 15-minute counseling appointments after each time, and people would come in and bare their hearts, and she told me, I want you to be in there. Now, I was in my 20s at that time. I want you to be in there. I want you to listen, and I want you to learn. And it was there that I learned the necessity of asking the important questions and the necessity of not necessarily bringing answers, but helping the person think of what the next thing to do is. And so I learned from there, and she certainly was not trained in the field, but just God put her in that position. He put me in that position. And then I sort of kept going down that path because I'm a people watcher. I'm an observer of behaviors. And I really got into this and began writing books about it when I did a radio program that lasted 3.5 years, and there was a lot of codependency involved between me and the other speaker. And I knew that I could not stay in a codependent relationship, and so I left. And I came back to Chattanooga, and I had nothing to do, nothing. So I went to the post office. That was my thing. If I could go to the post office, I felt like I'd had a good day. And I went there one day, and there was actually something in the post office box. And it was a very tiny little envelope, and the return address on it was New York, New York. It had an address in New York, but it was New York, New York. And I thought, who can possibly be writing me from New York, New York? Well, I opened it up, and on the inside, it was a crumpled up piece of pink paper, and it said, you who have endured the stinging experiences make God's best counselors. And that's a quote by Chuck Swindoll. And I wasn't sure what that meant or how it would apply to my life at that time. But I tried to write a thank you note. Remember, I didn't have anything else to do. I write a thank you note back to this person in New York, New York. Well, I did, and the reply came back, addressee unknown. So I don't know where it came from. I don't know who sent it to me. But it was really the announcement of what my life would be. And so from that time on, I was involved in counseling, because after that, after I left the radio program, after I got this note, two licensed counseling, PhD, Christian psychologist in the Chattanooga area called me and said, will you come and work with groups of women? And I thought it was funny. Some of you guys will think it's funny. They said, can you come and work with our women who woke up mad and don't get over it? I said, sure, I know that crew. And I was one of them. And so I began to work in groups with women about issues of codependency and relationships and that kind of thing. And that's how I really got started. One of them was a man who was a teacher at heart, and for 7 years, he taught me, as I would go into the counseling room, he taught me when I came out. He'd said, okay, what did you do with that? How did you go? And he would say, have you considered this? So he taught me to consider another way, that there's usually another way to look at things, and you don't look at it just as the first presentation. So I did all of that, and through that experience of working with people, most of my books have come out of that, and they're all about relationship. I can't get away from working, from talking about relationships and working with relationships. Yep.
Jan talked about maturity in the first hour. Maturity is not an automatic.
No.
You don't mature because you grow older. You mature because you learn things and you live your life out of those healthier things that you learn. So I recommend every one of her books. My first one I read was Please Don't Say You Need Me, the book on codependency. And so it was a great book. One of her best received books is one called Foolproofing Your Life. What did you learn about fools that you think is important to share?
Oh, dear. Now, fools, from the biblical perspective, are what we would call today narcissists. That word was not in vogue when I was writing fools. I recognized it, but I didn't know. I wrote the book Foolproofing because I kept meeting with couples. And one would come in and say, I don't have a problem. I don't know what her problem or his problem is. And you know what? And I think you're crazy. And so by the time we got to that, one of them would get up and leave. And I would think, Lord, there's a pattern here. Because it would just be a repeated event. And I thought, this, what is it? He said, have you ever read the book of Proverbs? And I said, yes, sir. And I went back and I read the book of Proverbs. And if you will go through Proverbs, you will see that God clearly defines the biblical fool. He defines that person as somebody who always thinks they're right, who uses anger to control, and who trusts in their own hearts. And you will find that repeated all the way through Proverbs. And basically he says, don't mess with this kind of person because you're going to fail. He says in Proverbs 13:20, which is one of my favorite scriptures, it says, if you hang with the wise, you will be wise. But the companion of fools, and that word companion means the person who hangs out in the field like a bunch of cows. If you hang out in the field with other fools, you will be not just another fool. You will be destroyed. And that word for destroyed means completely wiped out. So the Bible talks about that kind of person as being extremely dangerous and not the kind of person that you should be up close and personal with. In my book, foolproofing, I describe it like this because it was the only thing I could think of. If you're hanging out with a fool, it's like trying to hug a fan. You're going to get cut up. And that's just the way it's going to be. So if you recognize a fool, somebody who always thinks they're right, and that means that's the person who will never confess and never repent. And why would they? They're always right. So they have no reason to confess or to repent. They're always angry in some form. It may be that quiet, very cold anger that you're afraid to talk to them because you don't know what's going to come out of that coldness. Or it may be that volatile anger that somebody just gets in your face kind of anger. But either way, they're angry. And that's the only emotion I think they feel. According to the scripture, when you see the what God says about fools, they are divisive, they are liars, and they're angry. And then the third thing is it says that they trust in their own hearts. It means they don't, if they trust in your own heart, who do you not trust in? God. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And so you're in that situation. And so as I saw that, that's the background, that's the picture. But as I saw that, I have seen so many people living with people like that, or having children like that, or having mates like that, or having parents like that, or having pastors like that, people in authority like that, people you work with like that. You know, sometimes you work at a place and it's horrible. Why? Because you have somebody who always thinks they're right, they use anger to control, and they trust in their own hearts. And it's like, why is it always so hard? Why is it always hard around this person? You will find that around a fool or a narcissist, you can read on both, and it's all the same stuff, but it is impossible to be at peace. And the Bible says, as much as is within you, be at peace. But I can tell you on good authority, according to the book of Proverbs, you cannot be at peace with a fool. And you will not have peace as long as you're dealing with a fool.
In the first hour, she talked about people do what works.
Right.
So somebody pitches a fits all the time. It works for them. If somebody's always angry, it's working for them. You think, why would they want to stay like that? Because it's working for them. How many of you know somebody who's always pitiful? They're just always acting pitiful, poor me, and all that kind of stuff. Why they do that? You think, why wouldn't you want to be happy? Well, it's working for them. So you don't have any control over what they do, but you do have control over how you respond to it. And she talked about, realizing I'm not the problem. I'm not the reason they're that way. They have chosen to be that way.
Yes, the fool will often say to you, or I saw this in the interactions that I watch, they would say, well, if she didn't do that, then I wouldn't be this way. And it's that blame shifting that they're so good at. But, you know, there's so much material out on narcissists today, and it is right on. It just happens to do it in a secular way of what God spelled out in Proverbs so long ago. He had their number a long time ago, and he has no... I can honestly say that this is the one group of people where I see God saying, you know, that's who they are, that's who they want to be, let them. Because he does not, I don't see him in anywhere in the book of Proverbs, at least, interfering in the life of a fool, nor do I see it in the biblical characters who were fools in the scripture. You don't see God interfering. He says, if that's what you want, that's what you got. You know, when the children of Israel wanted a king because the other nations had a king, and he says, if you want a king, I'll give you a king. And who did he give them? Saul. And when he gave him that, I mean, they just went downhill, but they got a fool. You want a king? I'll give you a king. And, that's God. That's God who loves us, who allows those things. And you think, why wouldn't God protect us from that? Because sometimes We do not want to be protected. And I have seen many people continue on with fools in their lives because you don't want to be, we don't. It's not you personally, it's you generally, do not want to be protected from what God says. If you will back off from this, if you will get out of the fray in this situation, you will survive. But we say, no, I want to be up close and personal because I can fix it. Most people think you can fix a fool. A fool cannot be fixed. It's God, if they're ever going to be fixed. And I can say in my long experience, I have seen one person who looked like they had made it out of their folly, but they didn't. In the long run, they didn't.
So you can't change that person. So what you do is you learn how to protect yourself from them.
Exactly.
Somebody ought to write a good book on boundaries, teach people how to do that.
Yeah, somebody ought to do that.
Anyway, but that's what you do. Be careful what you want. God might let you have it. It happens in marriage all the time. Somebody finds somebody, they get attracted to them. Usually they start messing around. So now they have emotions that they wouldn't have otherwise. And now they have some guilt, and so they press on through. Everybody around them's raising red flags, but they ignore all the red flags. Marry the person anyway, turns out to be a nightmare. Be careful what you want. God might just let you have it. And that's what happened with the king in Israel. Rachel said, give me children or I'll die. When she got her second child, she died. She got what she wanted. So be careful of that. Now, you've been through a lot of change in the last 5 years. What would you want to tell us about the changes that come in our lives over which we have no control?
I would say, first of all, change is unexpected usually. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we look for. It's not something we can feel coming. It's usually just change. The changes I think that are the most difficult are those that happen instantaneously. And it's like one day you're here and the next day you're the next place. 6 years ago, we were having a birthday party for one of my sons, and the whole family was gathered, and it was on a Sunday, and we were all there and getting ready to have the blessing, and my husband fell over backwards and died. Just like that. Had no indication that he was sick. He'd been to church that morning. He had teased me about not being there, and I told him that some people needed it worse than others. Those were sort of my last words to him. And but he just died unexpectedly. And so we gathered at 1:00. The whole family was there. And by 3:30, we had already been to the hospital. He'd been declared dead. I had given his organs, signed for his organs to be donated. And we were back at the table having not eaten the hamburgers and the baked beans that had been cooked by 3:30. We were sitting there around the table saying, now what do we do? But you know, in God's goodness, He had prepared us, I think, as a family for a lot of the changes we've gone through, in that we're all pretty level-headed. Nobody gets hysterical. It's like, okay, this has happened, now what? And so we dealt with the now what. So that was a big change. I found out, I thought I was the glue that held the family together. I was the one that planned the parties. I was the one. I felt like I was. And then once Charlie died, I found out he was the glue that held the family together. I'm just the flippity gibbet on the outside that goes from here and does that and does this. But he was the solid rock. He was the glue that held us together. And we have struggled since that time being the family that we were, because once something like that happens, you're not the family that you were. It was one event in a lifetime of events, but that particular event changed everything. And then 3 years ago, well, 3 years ago in January, it was January the 2nd, and I got a phone call. And phone kept ringing, and it said the swim center in Ooltewah, Tennessee. And I thought, I don't want to talk to anybody at the swim center in Ooltewah, Tennessee. Finally, I answered the phone because they called so persistently. And I recognized this person as a friend of my second son. Her name is Wendy. And she said, Jonathan didn't show up for work today. She said, we've sent out a police, we sent out a wellness check for his house. She said, I just wanted you to know because that's, he never misses work. So I said, I'm on my way. So I went to the house, got to the house as quickly as I could. My son, one of my sons was already there, and the police had already been in, and his body had been found. And we don't know how long he had been gone. It was over New Year's weekend. We had seen him on Christmas. And the last interaction he had had was he'd bought some Chick-fil-A on Friday. And this was on Monday. And his dog was loose in the house. And, you know, it was one of those things you think, dear God, I don't think I can live through this. But I will. And so he died. And he died suddenly, obviously. And there was another change, because now there was another hole in the family. We were already trying to find ourselves without Charlie. And now without Jun, they called him Jun, no fun. No Jun, no fun. And so it was like, okay, now what do we do without Jun? Well, we cleaned out the house. You do what you do, and life goes on. And so it's been change after change after change. I sold the house after Charlie died. We had a big old house out in the woods outside of Chattanooga and Ooltewah. And I was going to age in place. That's what I was going to do. I was going to be a brave woman, and I fixed up the house. I had a lot of work done. I was going to age in place, and I was just going to be the matriarch who sat in the woods, I guess. And then one day it occurred to me, I am sick of sitting in the woods. I'm going to sell this place. And it happened to be when things were selling really well. And I thought, I think it would be smart if I'm going to do it right now. And so I sold the house in 24 hours. And then I thought, well, now where am I going to go? I didn't have a place to go. So I really had called my son before I put it up for sale. One of my sons. And because he had a lot of bedrooms and all of his kids were in college. And I called him and I said, I'm going to need a place to stay. What do you think? I'm going to sell the house. He said, sure. I said, you think you ought to ask your wife? And he said, yeah, I'll ask her, but she'll be fine with it. And she was. And they said, come on. So my dog and I moved into their house for 4.5 months, not knowing where we were going to go. And this was during COVID. And so I had COVID while I was there. I was a total delight. I had COVID while I was there. And, you know, I was everything you'd want your mother to be when she moved in. And so I was there for 4.5 months. And then I got a call out of the blue from a friend who said, would you be interested in an apartment on the ridge in Chattanooga? It's Missionary Ridge, and it's great view. And this was just a tiny little apartment under a friend's house. I said, sure, I'm interested. I hadn't even looked at it. And so I ended up moving into this apartment. It was perfect for the dog. It was perfect for me. It's two rooms. My closet is as big as from Rocky's knee over there to my knee here. That's it. That's the closet. And that's why I got rid of everything. And I live in a very tiny apartment. And things have changed. And I told the earlier service, and it's something you all need to hear, is that the last book I wrote, one of the chapters was on clean up after yourself before you go. Because your kids do not want your stuff. I just want you to know, your kids do not want your stuff. And you kids can sit here and look like, you don't want all that stuff. Because usually See, we came of age after our parents were in the Depression, and we were expected to take all of their stuff because they had come through the Depression and things were precious. And then after that, we had grown up in the war years, and so you just out of respect took mother's china, you took all their old furniture, you took it all because that's what you set up housekeeping with. But then you get to the next generation, which would be my children. They don't want your stuff because it's brown furniture. You don't want brown furniture in your house. And you sure don't need china. That china just breaks. And all of those linens and all of those pictures on the wall and those Yadro, those whatever they were, a lot of little ornaments. You sure don't want the collections and the little Hummels. You know, all the Hummels we collected. Well, you know, hold on to those. They're going to be worth money someday.
Did you get rid of your bobbleheads?
You know what? I didn't like those to begin with. But, you know, I mean, there were so many things we collected thinking they're going to be worth something someday. And now you have to pay people to haul it off. And so what I have learned is to get rid of stuff now because I don't want my boys to say, she has absolutely worn us out, not only in life, but now in death. We've got all of our mess. And so I've done something called the Swedish death cleanse. And doesn't that sound lovely? I told the kids that I wanted them to come over, that I was going to do a Swedish death cleanse. And they probably thought I was going to jump off the side of the ridge. But I said, now all it is you're just downsizing and getting rid of stuff. So even in my little apartment last week, we had a Swedish death cleanse and you know, it's amazing what you can collect when you don't have anything. You just add to it nothing and it piles up. So we got rid of a bunch of stuff and I could still get rid of stuff. But clean up after yourself before you go because your kids don't want all this stuff and they're going to thank you so much that they don't have a mess to clean up. If you've ever cleaned, I cleaned up after my parents. They were collectors. They collected pottery. And they thought that was going to be, you know, I guess that was going to be my inheritance. So I've had to get rid of pottery. I've had to move them out of a house, move my mother out of a house 3 times. I've moved moved out of my own house twice and then moved out of another house. And then when my son died, had his house to go through. My kids are tired of moving stuff because they've had to do it for their dad, for their brother, and I don't want them to, for me, I don't want them to say, let's just rake it all into the Tennessee River and be done with it because she's the last of the Mohicans here. But so I've tried to be circumspect and I've told the boys, you know what? If you'll just take half a day, you can take everything in here and do whatever you want to with it, and you're going to be done. I've gotten rid of old books, old pictures. You know those black and white pictures? You don't have any idea who those people are. And how many years have you kept them? And you look at them and think, they don't even look like us. I don't know who these people are. I found one picture that had these three. It was in Charlie's family stuff. It wasn't in ours. But he had these hunters, and they all had guns, and they had geese. And then there was one right in the middle of them that had a harp. It's not a harpsichord, but you know that you play in the fourth grade, that thing? Auto harp. He was holding an auto harp. And I thought, that's the weirdest picture I have ever seen. That has to be Charlie's side of the family. So I've kept it. And I explain it to people. I said, yes, those are Charlie's people. But you know, just think of the things that you've got that you just need to get rid of. Because it will bring peace to your soul and it will help your family.
So when you go through change, especially loss, most of the times you'll feel like, I don't know what to do. When you don't know what to do, do what you know to do. just do what you know to do. And we went through 10 years ago this difficult time in our lives. What did we do? You just had to do what you knew to do. And so that'll help you through some stuff.
Do the next thing. Yeah, whatever it is.
Grief is something we all will experience. Each of us will go through it differently. But there's lessons we can share with each other. What would you want to share with someone who's going through the grief of loss?
One of the things I would share is how to deal with people going through grief. And the one question you do not ask them is, how are you doing? How are you doing? I had just lost my son unexpectedly. And I know people didn't know what to say. They just didn't know what to say, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks out. And they would see me, and I knew what the question was coming. How are you doing? And I would want to say bad words. I would want to say, how in the do you think I am doing? It is terrible. My heart is broken, is shattered. I am crushed. That's how I'm doing. But what do we all do when people say, how are you doing? I'm fine. But in my heart, that wasn't what I wanted to say. Because I thought, you know, it's something we need to learn, that when people are going through grief, they're not themselves. I know I was not myself for at least a good year. One reason I know is because I became kind of crazy when it came to buying things. I bought 3 sofas. None of them worked, and I gave them away to my children. That was after Charlie died. I bought the 3 sofas. That was the grief after that, because he liked the same sofa we'd had for 30 years. And he would say, well, there's nothing wrong with it. And so as soon as he died, guess what? There was something wrong with it and went out the door. And I bought 3 different sofas, and it took me 3 times to settle in. Well, that was grief. You know, I wasn't being rebellious. I didn't buy expensive sofas, but I bought 3 sofas. And then I have traded cars 3 times. I never traded a car in my life. But I'm very good at it now. So I've traded cars, sold a house, never sold a house before. No stuff I never have known before. But, you know, after he died in the grief process, one of the grief processes was he always took the garbage cans to the street. And it was a long little walk in the house that we had to take the garbage cans to the street. And you had to get in front of it and kind of hold on to it because you'd lose it. And I would do that at night sometimes, and I'd think, Lord, why am I doing this? Why am I having to do this? He always did it. I mean, there were just things that you miss, and it hits you. You know, I might be fine all day until that night. And I found in grief with him that when the sun went down, that was my saddest time. I was fine all day, but then when it became dinner time, he always made it home for dinner, and I always cooked something. Well, I quit cooking, and he wasn't home, and the sun would go down, and there would be profound grief. It'd be like, life is never going to be the same, and it wasn't, and for a year, I ate chicken salad and Doritos. That was my dinner. And I lost 30 pounds, but gained it back. But I lost 30 pounds eating chicken salad and Doritos. It can be done. You know, the guy who did the Subway diet, you know, he ate Subways every day. Well, I think it was the consistency of what I ate. But the whole deal was, everything is thrown off in grief. Your routine is gone. The things that you counted on were gone. The things that were done for you as a wife were gone. It was gone. And you have to become okay with it. That's the thing. You have to get okay. And I knew I needed to get okay sooner than later, but it just took time. But then when Jonathan died, that was a whole nother story. And I'm not over that yet. And I don't think there's a time to be over it, especially if you lose a child. There's part of you has died. I mean, part of you physically has died. I remember being very, very foolish. I was interviewing a woman whose child had been studying about hanging. And she had gone to the grocery store, and he was about 12 years old, and he had stayed home by himself. She had two other boys who were with her. When she came back from the grocery store, he was hanging, and he was gone. And it was obvious that he had just been doing an experiment that he had been studying. It was a school thing that he had been studying because he had the block that he was standing on. Everything was set up so that he could have walked away from it. It was just a thing. But somehow the block he was standing on got kicked over and he died. And I asked her, very foolishly, I said to her, well, how long has it taken you to get over that? And this was like a couple of years later. I said, how long has it taken you to get over your son's death? And she looked at me and she leaned forward like this and she said, you never get over that. And I thought, wow. And so I kind of backed up and I thought that through later. And then I thought, but I'll never have to deal with that. I had three sons. I'll never have to deal with that. People ask me how many children you have. I've got three sons. Do you know what I say now? I don't answer. People don't ask me at this stage really how many children I have, but they may ask me about my grandchildren. But it used to be, yeah, I've got three sons. I was proud of that. I had three sons. It's like the TV program. I'm like the TV program. And now I don't talk about it. I don't say, well, I have two sons on earth and one son in heaven. Or I have two sons here and one son with Jesus. Or I have three sons. I don't have three sons here. So I just don't say. And that's just part of grief. I can't go there. And so grief is very unpredictable. You will be fine one minute, and the next minute there'll be a memory. There'll be something that you read, something you find. In this Swedish death clean, I found a card, a Mother's Day card that Jonathan had written to me when he was 9 years old. And across the top, it was in a little 9-year-old boy's hand. And across the top, he had said, of all the mothers I have had, you are the best. And then on the next line, it says, I want to keep you. And I thought, that was precious. I never knew he had so many mothers. But of all of them, I was the tops. So I just found that, and it just took me back to the funny little kid that had been such a joy to our life. I always said Jonathan's the one that taught me to pray, and he was, because he was always that kid. I had pictures even of him. I use this as an illustration. We go to the beach, and everybody was supposed to wear khaki and white, you know, for the beach picture. We'd get down there, and I've got one of my favorite pictures is of him. He's got on khaki on the bottom, but he's got striped. His shirt's all striped going this way. And I just left it like that because I thought that's the story of our lives with Jonathan. And it's precious to me because that was him. But that light in my life is gone. And so you just deal with grief as you deal with it. It takes time, but you never get over it. And you don't have to get over it. God doesn't expect you to get over it, but he does expect you to move on. There's a difference in getting over it and moving on. You move on and the grief goes with you. And part of you is broken, but it's okay. And you move on. And you just know that God knows. And I don't know, I don't understand it. This is not one of those things, well, I know what God was doing. I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. But the day that we found Jonathan, the only words that came to me were, God is still God. And that's one of those phrases I hang on to, Rocky, is God is still God. And that's all I know. And that's all I hang on to. And I know many of you have grief in your life, and there's no explanation for why. But God is still God. And that's sometimes where you have to leave it. And then someday, maybe we'll know. Someday, we won't necessarily have to know. I met a woman at a conference, and her son had gone hunting with her husband. And her son had shot her husband and killed him by mistake. Kid tripped on a rifle and shot him. And she said to me, everybody at the conference says, oh, you've got to meet Mary. You've got to meet Mary. So I met Mary and I said, tell me your story. And she told me what happened. And then she said, I said, well, someday you'll know. She said, someday, as to why it happened. And she said, someday, I don't think I'll want to know or I'll need to know because I'll be in the presence of Jesus. And I thought, that makes sense, because there's a lot of junk that happens on this earth that when we're in the presence of Jesus, it's just, we're going to know as we're known, and it doesn't matter. But right now, it feels like we need an answer. But we don't always get the answers. But God is still God. And that's the good news. He's still God.
Deep grief, you don't move on from it. You move on with it.
Exactly.
And especially if you're married, or this could be wider circle than that, everybody has to take their own journey through it. And most men tend to be more resilient, and we would get through it quicker, more quickly than our wives would, or our daughters maybe, possibly sons or husbands. But you got to let everybody take their own journey. You should never think, okay, it's been 6 months, you ought to be over this by now, you know, or it's been a year or whatever. And, you know, maybe 2 years later, like Jan said, you find something triggers something, and you're a puddle of tears. You just think about it again. You always, it goes on with you, but you have to go on. You have to go on. Okay, we got time for one more here.
Okay.
How has your relationship with God changed through the years?
Well, it started out, my relationship with God started out kind of on an iffy path, because I did the go forward when you're 6 years old and be baptized, and then, you know, you're good. And then I found out that when I hit my teenage years and went away to camp and got some freedom and could drive the car, I wasn't all that good. I wasn't that secure. But I did all the churchy things. I did all the right things, but I knew I was lost as a goose. And I really didn't care. And in fact, I got into reincarnation, because you can't get into reincarnation, but I studied reincarnation because I didn't want to die. And in reincarnation, you don't have to die, in case that's bothering any of y'all. You don't have to die. You just go around and around and around. And so I just figured I had been a barmaid in England or something like that, and that would just be where I would go to the next, you know, to the next thing. I really believe this stuff. Although I had been raised in the church. I mean, I was a Looney Tune, just a total Looney Tune, and I believed it. But I struggled. The reason I struggled was because in some of my wanderings as a 12 or 13-year-old, I had gone on a camping trip. My mother drove for it, and we had all these Girl Scouts or whatever they were, and we went to New England. And I got the short end of the stick, and I got into the tent with a much older girl. And I was doing my daily Bible readings because I had all the trappings of being a good Christian girl. And this girl looked at me as I was reading the Bible, and she said, "You don't believe all that stuff, do you? Mary and Joseph were just messing around. So you don't believe it." And I thought, well, yeah, I kind of do. And that was the flip over into, I closed my Bible, and then I didn't open it again really to read it until I was 26 years old when I came to Christ. And in the meantime, I had had the journey of being the barmaid in England and all of those, you know, I had been on a far journey and believed a lot of stuff and a lot of junk. But then when I came to know the Lord, He changed me. And that's how you know you have come to know the Lord. You can believe intellectually, but with the heart, there's got to be some sort of change. When the Lord of glory moves in, He moves in. Now, it may not be, you know, sparkles and lights and you're just, you may not be that kind of person. I'm not. I'd respond intellectually. And I knew I couldn't keep lying. And I mentioned this in the first service, but I can tell you that's one way I knew I had changed, because I could lie and cover up whatever I had done, especially when it came to money with Charlie, who didn't like to spend money. And I like to spend money. And so I would, some of you men know that. I can see you're saying, I knew you were that type. But I would spend $50, and he would say, well, how much is this check for? Because I would always conveniently leave that out. He'd say, how much is this check for? You young people remember what checks are? We used to have to write stuff down. And it was 50, I'd say it was 15 instead of 50, because I knew he wouldn't like 50, but he wouldn't mind 15. And so, but I could lie. And what I came to know when I came to him, or when he came to me, was you can't lie. That's not, that doesn't go along with who you are and who I am in you. So things began to change. I began to understand things about the Bible. I began to listen to radio preachers, even some of those that would go, you know, something like that. And I thought, well, he's making sense. I mean, you know, because before I had just made fun of him. I had just laughed and made fun of him. And then when it began to make sense, I thought, uh-oh, something's happened to me. Because I get what he's saying, and I would get the word. And when I read the word, it made sense. That's one of the ways you know it's real, because the Bible makes sense. And it's like, oh, it is alive and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword. So that's what has changed me. It's being in the Word. I was in the Word through precept studies. I was in the Word. I had an amazing pastor, your friend, my friend, Wayne Barber. And I had an amazing pastor. And I understood the Word. And as I understood the Word, I knew that it changed me, because it was as if when I blew it, and I blew it often and still do, but it was as if something within me was crying and I couldn't stand it. And I didn't want to hurt that person who was in me because I had sinned against him. And so I would say, oh God, I'm so sorry. And I knew what it was. I knew the Holy Spirit within me was disappointed because I had done my own thing, or I'd gone off on something. You know, all those things we can do. So I can tell you, I can spot truth. That's another thing in coming to know the Lord. I can spot truth, and I can spot falsehood when it comes to spiritual things. I know, and that is what I know. I know that I know that I know when I hear truth, and I know that I know that I know when I hear something false. And I can tell when it's a half a bubble off, because the Holy Spirit within me is there. And so those are some of the ways that it's changed. And just walking with him, I feel loved. Even when I'm not, I can tell you, since I've been in this grief thing the last couple of years, I haven't been worth shooting when it comes to, you know, I haven't studied a lot. I haven't done a lot that I used to do, because I just haven't wanted to. But I've been loved. I have been so loved, and I have been comforted, and the Holy Spirit is our comforter. And I have been allowed to grieve, and I have been held. And I know that it's Him, because there's nobody else there. And so it's Him. And it has been sweet, and it's been tender. And as I look back, there are two things. As I look back, I can see those places along the way where He has profoundly showed up. It's kind of like those markers. You look back, and that's where faith comes from. I have faith. He's been there before. He'll be there again. And then that's it. In the future, I know He's going to be there. And there's an old song that says, He'll be there when I'm dying. I think it was Hazel, and I'm not sure, it's a couple of old country singers, but it was a great, He'll be there when I'm dying. And I know He will be, so I'm not worried about that either. So that's my relationship with Him.
Do you remember Ron Dunn talking about we see God in retrospect?
Yes.
Yeah. We're in a problem, wondering where God is, why isn't He doing something? On the other side of the problem, we look back and we realize He was there. He was carrying us. He was doing all these things. I'm sure you'd concur. Through all the ups and downs of life, disappointments, hurts, et cetera, more and more things you can't explain. You know, when something bad happens, we ask why. Usually we ask, why me? Why?
Yeah.
The question to ask is what? What now? What do I do now?
Yeah.
And so that's how we go on, is we got to say, what now? This has happened. You can't undo it. And when I was young, I used to tell people when I first came here, 27 years old, I had all the answers. It's because I didn't know what the questions were.
Yeah.
And so now I know what all the questions are, and I don't have all the answers.
Right.
And there's all kinds of things about God I can't explain and don't know, even though I know Him and His Word way more than I ever have. And the great part about it, which is why it made me think of this, is I love Him and trust Him more than I ever have. Even with questions.
Right.
Even with all the things I don't understand. Why did this have to happen? Why did this have to happen to me or this somebody I loved, et cetera, et cetera? Over time, none of that has diminished my faith or trust or love for Him. It's all grown through it all. And that's just, if you walk with the Lord, that's how it goes. You don't know everything, but you know Him.
Right.
And knowing Him's enough.
Right. And he's trustworthy because He doesn't change. You change, everything around you changes. Mm-hmm. But He stays the same.
I'll say this. In a world where everything changes, isn't it great to come to someone who never does?
He never changes.
You just heard from author and speaker Jan Sylvius, and you should take a look at Jan's books on Amazon, like Foolproofing Your Life, Courage for the Unknown Season, and even more great titles. Well, we hope you enjoyed today's message. And if you did, why don't you join us for a service this Sunday? We get started at 10:15 on Sunday mornings, but if you can't join us in person, head over to CorrietonChurch.com to watch Corrieton Live this Sunday or Wednesday. The hosts on Corrieton Live would love to speak with you in the chat, so tune in this week.